Calculus of the Nervous System by Emily Howard. You just heard the first UK performance here at the BBC Proms with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andris Nelsons. The orchestra is standing the back of the first violins, moving their chairs to allow Emily onto the platform, shaking hands with Andris Nelsons and leader Lawrence Jackson, and bowing to the promenaders in front of her in the arena and everybody around the hall, applauding conductor and orchestra for that performance. It was actually commissioned by the Wien Modern Festival as part of the festival's composer focus on Emily's music, first performance last November, conducted by James McMillan in Vienna. And it's one of Emily Howard's Lovelace trilogy, alongside the dramatic vocal work Ada Sketches and Mesmerism for piano and chamber orchestra. And she told me earlier she's also thinking about an opera on Ada Lovelace, really getting maximum musical value for money from her fellow mathematician. Well, Emily Howard's new piece linked us to one of the major sieges in British history 4 centuries ago, when the city of Chester fell as its population was starved over the course of a year. In Soviet Russia, almost exactly 3 centuries later, the German army laid siege to Leningrad, and the city became a symbol of Russian defiance. And so did Dmitri Shostakovich's 7th Symphony, written with the Germans camped outside the gates, a requiem for the many hundreds of thousands who died, and an eloquent testament to the terrors of totalitarianism, perhaps as much at home as abroad. Andris Nelsons conducts Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony in the second half of this evening's prom. And don't forget that you'll find full details of the concert on the prom's website, and you can also listen online in HD sound. Well, now it's time to join Ian McMillan and his guests for this evening's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier at the Royal College of Music across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Welcome to this evening's literary prom, and I'm glad that our hall here at the Royal College of Music isn't vast and gloomy, because tonight we're celebrating Russian literature, which is often seen as being vast and gloomy. Well, to be honest, sometimes it is vast and gloomy. Our guides through the steps, the samovar houses, and the endless slow train journeys full of stout men and women in fur hats are the novelist Pat Barker and the Church of England priest Giles Fraser. Pat Barker is perhaps best known for a regeneration trilogy, which takes an epic and yet deeply personal sweep across the First World War. I love her early book, Union Street, stories about women like my mam and my auntie Mabel, the kinds of women who didn't often get written about in books. Giles Fraser is a priest who gets deeply involved in the world. He is, I believe, one of the few people who's written for The Guardian, The Daily Mail and The Socialist Worker. He resigned his post as Canon Chancellor of St Paul's Cathedral last October because of the authorities' response to the Occupy protesters. He's currently priest in charge of St Mary's Church, Newington, in South London. And our extracts are going to be read by Melanie Gray. Please welcome them all. So we're talking about Russian literature tonight, and I know you've both chosen huge, towering classics of Russian literature. Tolstoy's War and Peace and Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov are the novels of vast scope and ambition, but ultimately, of course, about people. And it seems to me that both authors and priests need that same patience with human complexity. Pat, do you think that's the case?
I think priests probably need patience. I think what novelists need is delight in human complexity. It is, after all, the way in which we earn our living.
But there's also has to be a bit of patience while the characters work their way through, I guess.
Certainly the patience is required when you first start writing about a character and you're trying to establish the voice. And sometimes that comes quickly and easily, and sometimes it takes months and months, and the waste paper basket gets fuller and fuller.
And at that time, it's patience with yourself, I guess, as well as the character.
Oh, with the process. Patience with the process, I think. It can't be hurried.
And what about you, Giles?
Well, it's true. A good priest needs patience, which is probably why I'm not a very good priest, because I'm a terribly impatient thing. It's very difficult. You must listen. You must be someone who's able to listen. And some people listen by being quiet and letting the other person speak, and some people listen by being in some sort of conversation with them and so forth. And I guess I justify my impatience as a different form of listening, as a way of listening through conversation, but I'm a terribly impatient person. But it's absolutely true that the complexity of the world is our business. I mean, one of the great things about being a priest, wearing a dog collar, which I don't do very often, is it's an access all areas pass. I mean, you can sort of go anywhere with a dog collar, and you actually really do get to see the world in all its complexity. It's a huge privilege to do that.
Now, you've chosen an extract from the Brothers Karamazov. Now, D.H. Lawrence hated this book. He said it made his heart sink. So why do you love it?
Well, it's not a book to love. It's a wonderfully brave book about the human condition and about faith. And what I particularly love is how brave Dostoevsky is because he gives... He's so sort of porous, so open, so non-defenseless to what's going on in the world that he's prepared to give the best arguments in the book to the people he disagrees with. And I think that's the most extraordinary thing. So, you know, one of the passages that we're going to hear from in a minute is Ivan Karamazov, and it's a sort of condemnation of the church and of Christianity. And yet, and he gets the best arguments in the book, and yet that's not Dostoevsky at all.
So could you introduce the bit that we're about here? What's just happened?
Yes, I mean, this is one of the most terrifying passages in literature. Christ returns in the middle of the Inquisition, and the Grand Inquisitor, this ancient priest, comes out, finds Christ on the steps of the cathedral, has just raised a small child to life. And then what happens? You'd expect the great bishop to celebrate him and welcome him. He arrests him, and then this is what happens.
All right, let's hear it. Our reader is Melanie Gray.
In the pitch darkness, the iron door of the prison is suddenly opened, and the Grand Inquisitor himself comes in with a light in his hand. He is alone. The door is closed at once behind him. He stands in the doorway and for a minute or two gazes into his face. At last, he goes up slowly, sets the light on the table, and speaks. Is it you? You. But receiving no answer, he adds at once, Don't answer. Be silent. What can you say, indeed? I know too well what you would say, and you have no right to add anything to what you said of old. Why then are you come to hinder us? For you have come to hinder us, and you know that. But do you know what will be tomorrow? I know not who you are, and care not to know whether it is you or only a semblance of him, but tomorrow I shall condemn you and burn you at the stake as the worst of heretics. And the very people who have today kissed your feet, tomorrow at the faintest sign from me will rush to heap up the embers of your fire. Know you that? Yes, maybe you know it. For if anyone has ever deserved our fires, it is you. Tomorrow I shall burn you. When the Inquisitor ceased speaking, he waited some time for the prisoner to answer him. His silence weighed down upon him. He saw that the prisoner had listened intently all the time, looking gently in his face and evidently not wishing to reply. The old man longed for him to say something, however bitter and terrible. But he suddenly approached the old man in silence and softly kissed him on his bloodless, aged lips. That was all his answer. The old man shuddered. His lips moved. He went to the door, opened it, and said to him, Go, and come no more. Come not at all, never, never. And he let him out into the dark alleys of the town. The prisoner went away. And the old man? The kiss glows in his heart, but the old man adheres to his idea.
Thank you very much. Now, Giles, one of the brothers is religious, one's a sceptic. How do you find yourself responding to their religious debates?
Well, it's not even a debate. I mean, Alyosha, who's the religious one, doesn't have very good arguments. He's not as clever as the rationalist one. And yet what Dostoevsky, I think, is trying to do here is trying to say, you know, he has a real problem with rationalism. Mm. And he's saying, yeah, the arguments are really great, that the chapter before this one is another chapter called Rebellion about the problem of evil, the problem of suffering children. So all these arguments are absolutely right. And all he has to counter it is this sort of simple novice monk and a kiss, and the idea that that's his argument. Mm. And for me, it's absolutely extraordinary. And Dostoevsky's so non-defensive about his his faith and where he is. I mean, he even says at one point, if the truth is on one side and Christ is on the other, I go with Christ and not the truth. Now, I mean, that sounds madness, absolute madness. You know, I just go with that kiss, which warms the heart. And, I mean, the other religious figure in it, Zosima, I mean, he's really dull. You know, I mean, he's not... These aren't... You know, the salvation doesn't come through the church or churchy people or the best arguments, but there's this kiss which just won't go away. And, what's terrifying about that passage, absolutely terrifying, is the church... You know, this is... Ivan is telling this story, the rationalist, and he's saying the church sometimes... often betrays Christianity. Christ is too Christian. He lets people have freedom, and the church is against Christ. And, you know, Dostoevsky knows that's sometimes right.
And Pat, how do you respond to this novel?
I'm quite interested in the fact that both Aloysia, that's the religious young monk, and Ivan are actually in a very precarious situation. With regard to their respective faiths. Aloysia seems to think that when his elder, Zosimo, whom he really reveres, dies, a miracle is expected, and the miracle is that Zosimo's body will not decay, rather like the body of St. Cuthbert, if you come from Durham. But in fact, what happens is quite contrary to that. The body putrefies with extraordinary rapidity. The cell stinks in no time at all. And Aloysia is actually deeply troubled by that. But Ivan, too, is in almost the same situation because he tells these terrible, terrible stories about the torture of children, which I can hardly bear to read. And all he really has to oppose to that is the fact that every spring he feels the sticky green leaves and he knows he loves life. But we know that actually, as a young man, that is a complete answer. It's animal high spirits. But as an old man, that is not going to be enough. And neither of their faiths actually is tenable.
Can I ask you whether you feel that nationality has a part to play in reading novels like this? Is our response inevitably non-Russian, or does it transcend that kind of nationality, do you think?
It's virtually impossible to... imagine three Englishmen going on in quite this way. Mm. Yeah, I think it is peculiarly Russian. What interests me is in the communist period, how did a communist read all this? I think that's much more of a barrier than not being Russian.
What about you, Giles? We're not Russian, so we have to respond to it in a different way, don't we?
Yes, I was actually talking to a friend of mine who speaks Russian, who's a Russianist this afternoon, and he was saying about the difference between Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. With Tolstoy, the art, the language is so important that when you read him in Russian in translation, you get so much more. With Dostoevsky, he says, actually he's painting with a sort of very broad brush. It's ideas, it's sort of characters, it's big pictures. And so he was saying he thought you don't need as much Russian to get Dostoevsky as you do to get Tolstoy. And that sort of made sense to me, because Tolstoy is about the characters rather than the sort of aesthetics of the language.
True, because, Pat, you've chosen War and Peace as your extract.
Yes, I have.
And it is epic writing. Did it influence when you were writing Regeneration, that trilogy?
Not consciously, but I read it very early, and if you read a book early, it probably does have an unconscious influence. I mean, when I wrote Regeneration, I used real characters, historical characters and fictional characters together, and I used to be asked at the time, are you writing faction? And I used to say, well, only in the sense that Shakespeare and Tolstoy were writing faction, not that I would mention my own work in the same breath as either of them. But it is important to realise that the rules are there to be broken, essentially. The passage I've chosen is one where Tolstoy does use a fictional character and brings him face to face with a real character, Napoleon Bonaparte. And the fictional character is called Prince Andrei. And Napoleon, as the great reformer of France, has always been Prince Andrei's hero.
All right, well, let's hear the extract.
Prince Andrei, who had been thrust forward under the emperor's eyes to complete the array of prisoners, could not fail to attract his attention. Napoleon apparently remembered seeing him on the battlefield, and addressing him, he used the same epithet, jeune homme, with which his first sight of Bolkonski was associated in his memory. "Well, and you, young man," said he, "how do you feel, mon brave?" Although 5 minutes previously Prince Andrei had been able to say a few words to the soldiers who were carrying him, now, with his eyes fixed steadily on Napoleon, he was silent. So trivial seemed to him at that moment all the interests that engrossed Napoleon, so petty did his hero, with his paltry vanity and delight in victory, appear compared to that lofty, righteous, and kindly sky which he had seen and comprehended, that he could not answer him. Everything did, indeed, seem so futile and insignificant in comparison with the stern and solemn train of thought induced in him by his lapsing consciousness, as his lifeblood ebbed away, but his suffering and the nearness of death. Gazing into Napoleon's eyes, Prince Andrei mused on the unimportance of greatness, the unimportance of life which no one could understand, and the still greater unimportance of death, the meaning of which no one alive could understand or explain. The emperor, after pausing in vain for an answer, turned away and said to one of the officers as he moved on, "See that these gentlemen are looked after and taken to my bivouac. Let my surgeon, Dr. Leray, attend to their wounds. Au revoir, Prince Repnin." And he spurred his horse and galloped away. His face was radiant with happiness and self-satisfaction.
So War and Peace is partly about that relationship between huge events and individuals and how the two mesh together. And the book has a kind of philosophical angle on that as well, doesn't it?
Well, yes. When Tolstoy was researching the book, he read every history of the 1812 invasion, both in Russian and in French, and he wasn't very impressed by them, actually, because they all emphasised the overriding importance of great men. And Tolstoy believed that great men were of very superficial importance and that their power was often illusory. And he believed that the great change in history is driven by myriads and myriads of ordinary people doing apparently quite insignificant things. And, you know, part of his... all of his ambition in War and Peace was to give a sense of that swarm of humanity taking these tiny little decisions, often in ignorance of what was happening, and how those tiny little decisions come together and produce radical change.
It's funny, though, isn't it, as well, that we tend to associate this kind of novel with 19th century writers. But I don't think that's correct, because you think contemporary novels can be and are as ambitious. Think of things like A Suitable Boy or Midnight's Children or your trilogy. So somehow we can be as ambitious, can't we, in the 20th and 21st centuries?
Yes, and I think... I don't know whether Tolstoy is being very daring and breaking the rules. I think perhaps he was making the rules as he went along, as a, you know, a genius of that stature can do.
Do you think this is the point where it's difficult for us as non-Russians to get something? Because all that love that you have in lots of Russian literature with the peasantry,
yes,
and, you know, living close to the land and all that stuff about, I mean, even that stuff about nature, I mean, why he likes peasants, is there a part of, and you get this, this is a sort of conversion experience, isn't it, that we have in this reading. And part of the conversion is that he suddenly sees the sky, feels a part of the nature of things. And there's something about that you get here, the Russian soul is close to, through the peasantry, is close to nature. There's something there that, I guess, I live in the Elephant and Castle, so it
yes,
just, it isn't something that really, it doesn't really sort of grip me. But there's something there I see as quite distinctive.
I would certainly agree with that. I can't think of any English novel. Adam Bede, perhaps, would be the closest, where there's the same sense of it being beneficial to get in touch with the common people. I don't think it's something we have, but then we didn't have a system of slavery, which, of course, at this stage, they still did. It had been only recently been abolished when Tolstoy was writing the novel.
And we don't only read them through the prism of history, we also read them through a kind of fog, if you like, of translation. And what do you think we're missing by not reading them in the right way?
I would need to speak Russian to know what we were missing. I mean, I think you always know when you're reading poetry that you're probably missing at least 80 or 90% of what the poet originally wrote. But I think in novels it's quite difficult to know what you're missing, and I think it probably varies very much from novelist to novelist.
And you also get, I mean, the other difference that separates us from both of these authors is something about the Russian Orthodox Church, the importance of faith to these people, that things like icons for Dostoevsky, for the church, how that sort of bleeds into nationalism. That is something that when we're reading it now, especially in sort of secular 21st century, that really puts many people at a distance from this. They can't see what all the fuss is about, why it's such a drama. And yet for them, it is, in a different way, life and death stuff. I mean, Tolstoy wants to... I always think of Tolstoy as a bit of a rationalist. He wants to sort of get some sort of order handle on everything. Dostoevsky is much happier to let things go, but they're still responding to a similar sort of problematic, I guess.
I think that is also part of the Victorian experience in England, though, this sense that if there isn't a God and there isn't immortality, then there is no reason for anybody to live a moral life. But then, as George Eliot said, there is no God, and yet we must be good. But, you know, you don't have to agree with her.
So, very briefly, then, at the end, these are seen as difficult books. People are put off by the vastness of them. They're tough to finish. Can I ask each of you for your advice to a beginner, Charles? If you're starting off, where what would you begin with?
Well, I've got to tell you, I'm a terrible reader. I'm a really terrible reader. And so I really am... I mean, I have to tell this terrible secret, I'm on the radio, but I've just bribed my daughter with cash money to read Anna Karenina. So I just wanted to go and read it. So there's, but once you just immerse yourself in it, for me, the reading is actually quite difficult. But the ideas that flow out of it, they last a lifetime.
All right, and Pat, would you offer money?
Well, no, but I'm going to say something even more shocking. When you're dealing with something of the size of War and Peace or The Brothers Karamazov, why not buy yourself some of these lovely little Cliff Notes or Sparks Notes, which people use as crammers when they're working for an exam? Simply because they will give you the lines of the story. And it's certainly not a substitute for actually reading and immersing yourself in the work, but they do act as a kind of map.
I used to love those. Classics Illustrated.
Yes.
Remember them? Little comics. War and Peace in 16 pages. Thank you very much to my guests, Giles Fraser and Pat Barker, and to our reader, Melanie Gray. We've been discussing The Brothers Karamazov and War and Peace, which I hope you'll all go off and read before tomorrow. Thank you very much.
It's going to take longer than that. Ian McMillan presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Laura Thomas. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the Royal Albert Hall, where we're about to hear the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra reliving the Siege of Leningrad in a performance of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, his Leningrad Symphony, conducted by Andris Nelsons. And we'll hear what the orchestra's Latvian music director thinks of the piece in a moment or two, but I'm joined right now in the presentation box by the orchestra's chief executive, Stephen Madigan. Stephen, we're four seasons into Andris Nelsons' stewardship of the orchestra, and there's still a real buzz about the partnership. How would you say they've changed, evolved over the last 4 years?
Well, I think, of course, orchestras have to continue to evolve to survive. For us, that's been a lot of it has been to do with the repertoire we play. So these big Russian and German pieces, a lot of opera, a lot of Wagner, which is one of Andris's passions. We played the complete Tristan and Isolde earlier this year, which is the first time the orchestra had ever played it. That was an amazing experience, you know, life-changing thing for people.
It's such a thrill for symphony orchestras to get their teeth into that kind of repertoire.
Fantastic.
They just don't get it the rest of the time.
Absolutely. We're doing The Flying Dutchman next year. So opera has been a strong thing, and because Andris is such a great opera conductor, but also it's about the way of playing, and you'll hear in this Shostakovich there's just a kind of no holds barred, no prisoners way of conducting, which takes a little while to adjust to for new orchestras, but now is just so thrilling for us that every performance feels like an event.
Well, they're coming onto the stage as we're talking. Just very, very briefly, I know it's a really busy summer. Where are you heading next?
Well, the next thing for us is Edinburgh Festival next week for Sibelius 2 and Goodbye Dulina, and then a four-concert residency at the Lucerne Festival in Switzerland. So, again, big pieces, Mahler 2, Beethoven 9, and Shostakovich. So, great honour for us to be there for a residency, and very exciting place to be.
Stephen, thanks very much for joining us. It's great to have you all back at the BBC Proms. Well, let's find out right away exactly why this dynamic young conductor liked Shostakovich so much, and especially his Seventh Symphony.
everything he writes is a genius work, whether he writes for films, theater, for string quartet, for symphony orchestra or opera. In my feeling, I would call him Russian Mozart, you know, because everything Mozart wrote was really a masterpiece. And I think the same with Shostakovich. Any piece you take, it's a masterpiece. And therefore, it shows to me that we sometimes over-politicize his music. It is also a music just genius by itself, even if there was no war. And this is one of these victory pieces where it ends so powerful that there is no chance that Hitler would have won the war. I mean, after hearing this symphony.
Andrus Nelson's. As far as I know, Hitler didn't hear the Leningrad Symphony, but some of his soldiers certainly did, as it was broadcast to them on loudspeakers from the besieged city itself. But Shostakovich wrote in his original programme, though, that he hadn't composed so-called battle music. He wanted to convey the content of terrifying events, which he does after the first movement's opening theme with the so-called invasion theme that begins with the rattle of the solo snare drum and builds inexorably, a march using musical ideas from Shostakovich's own opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, and from Lear's operetta, The Merry Widow, which is reputed to have been one of Hitler's favourites. Shostakovich called the central part of the first movement a requiem for the heroes who died for us. The symphony's two middle movements originally carried the titles Memories and The Homeland's Vistas, and the finale ultimately delivers the triumphant return of the symphony's opening theme, battered but unbroken. And to transport us to the siege of Leningrad in 1941, here's Andrus Nelson's to conduct the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony.
Thank you. Yeah!